Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who is and is and is to come. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who is and is and is. Thank you, Father, for everyone that's gathered here, Lord, and I thank you that you have redeemed us from sin and death and called us into a new life, made us a new creation, and given us purpose and works to walk in that you had in mind for us from before you made the world. It's too wonderful for us. But it's true, so I ask you, Father, to help us believe. Help us believe you in the deepest way as to why you made us, as to the purpose you have for us, and the power you've given us through the work of your Son and the shedding of his blood, his dying and rising from the dead, by which he was declared the Son of God in power, that we would believe, Lord, that you would breathe on us and give us a new revive us anew and convince us anew and release us, Father, to walk in the things that you made for us. In Yeshua's name. Be Maru. So, this message is going to be called "If You Can." Okay, remember that. But I have a question for you. If you came upon somebody who was in like really bad shape, maybe unconscious, and you had the power to save their life, would you do it? You would do it? Okay. That's good. So as an object lesson, I'm going to show you this little blue bag. Is it mysterious? The contents of this little blue bag, if you had it, and you could just overcome your whatever fear you had, when you came upon somebody who had overdosed on opiates, in 3 minutes you could learn how to do this if you had these little things here. And by the way, from what I can understand, if you're wrong and they're not on opiates, it won't hurt them. And if they can't tell you, you might not be able to be sure, but there are signs you can look for. But it could be something else, but apparently you can't really do anybody any harm if you're wrong. So at any rate, you come across somebody like that, you figure, oh, they've overdosed on, you know, pain medication or stuff they bought on the street that has who knows what in it. and they're going to die from an overdose. So you take this little thing out, you grab a hold of it, after doing a few other things, like you try to get them to talk if they won't talk, and you look for the signs, which I won't go all into at the moment. Then you take hold of this little thing after you take it out. There are instructions in the bag, too, by the way. And you hold it like this, and you tip their head back a little bit, and you stick that thing in their nose, and you go, squirt. Then you wait 2 minutes. And if they come to, then it will actually, I don't know if before or after, you should call 911. Because there might be more needed than just what you can do. But you can save their life by squirting that stuff up their nose. If nothing happens in 2 minutes, there's another one of these in the bag. 2 or 3 minutes. You stick that in their nose and you squirt it again. And then they might come too. And if you just do that, you could save their life. Because what that stuff does is, it's really kind of amazing, and I can't explain it perfectly. But it's Narcan. That's probably a trade name. It goes in and it binds the drug itself so that it can't get in touch with the receptors that pick it up. And then it lasts long enough so that not all the drug will be gone, but it begins to break down in the amount of time that stays bound to it. And then so it cancels out the effect, not necessarily of all of it. And apparently you don't actually want to cancel all of it because then the person might go into like really extreme withdrawal, and they're probably not going to feel that good if the first one works. You don't want to just whack them with another one. On the other hand, if you have enough of these available, you can keep doing it every 2 or 3 minutes until they come to. So you could quite easily save somebody's life with these little things. If you could just overcome your fear of getting involved. And not everybody wants to do it. The person I got this from told me, I hope you never have to use it. And I said, well, actually, I hope I do have to use it. Because I hope that when somebody's about to die and there's nobody else there to help them, that I turn up there. I hope I do have to use it. Of course, if what you mean is you hope nobody anywhere overdoses, yeah, I agree with that. But I hope that when somebody overdoses and they're going to die, somebody is there to save their life. And if it's me, that's fine. I'll squirt that stuff up their nose. By the way, if I was in that situation, I would probably have to overcome some resistance in myself to just rush in there, try to figure it out, and get involved. Because I don't necessarily like dashing into difficult situations, even though, well, some of you may have seen me just run right into some of them. I'm not sure. Sometimes I do. You know, not every day is the same. So anyway, to go on, if you had the power in you to save someone from eternal death, would you do it? Yeah. The next question is easy but harder. Do you have that power in you? Who said yes? Anyone say no? Anyone unsure? Okay, the scriptures say, greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. And that he that is in you is the one that has conquered sin and death. So you don't have to claim special power of your own. See, if I'm going to use this thing, I don't have to claim that I invented it. I don't have to claim that it comes out of my personal system and goes into them. I don't have to claim that I own the power. I just have to use it. That's all. I just have to use it. I could save somebody's life. I don't even have to understand how it works. All I need to do is believe that a person matters enough to save their life and believe that this stuff will do what I've been told it'll do, even if I have no idea how it works. Right? Most of you have heard of this stuff, haven't you? Really? How many have heard of Narcan? Well, I don't know. Maybe less than half. I'm not sure. Has anyone heard of something called the opiate crisis? Whoa. Okay, opioid. Opioid crisis, yeah. I think, is there anybody that hasn't heard of that? There's no shame if you haven't, but it's like, okay, it's like an epidemic is what they're calling it. And strangely enough, it's apparently worse in small-town America than in big-city America. Anyway, you don't have to be a great theologian to use this. You don't have to have every Bible verse memorized to use this. In fact, you don't even have to know or believe anything to use this and save somebody's life with it. Now, what? In terms of Yeshua, I don't know. How much do you have to know to share the good news in Yeshua with somebody and have them come to faith in Yeshua and be saved? How much do you have to know? What? I can't hear you.
You have to know the good news.
Okay, yeah, you have to know the good news. So if you know the good news, like, I mean, the average person, if there is such a thing, that has come to faith, in the moment when they actually came to faith, you think a lot of them knew, like, lots of scripture, had lots of scripture memorized, had read R.C. Sproul to find out the way things really work theologically? R.C. Sproul isn't the only one that can tell you how it really works. I'm not saying anything against him, by the way, nor endorsing him. I'm not doing either one at the moment. What I've noticed is this world is full of people that know God that in faith and conviction do what they believe the Lord has called them to, and they have an effect in this world that's very positive, even if their theology is what one of us would say wrong. Like, for instance, anyone ever heard of George Whitefield? Well, Whitefield, I believe, was a Calvinist. All kinds of people came to faith. I mean, just bizarre stuff. I mean, things that don't make natural sense happened under his ministry. He would get up and speak. I mean, people came flocking. Jonathan Edwards, in the day of Jonathan Edwards, spontaneously, everybody in the whole village. This just happened. No, there were no plans. This wasn't announced. Everybody just walked out of their house and headed to the church. Some of you probably know all of that stuff much better than I do. Something called them, and it wasn't an announcement, and it wasn't the promise of a special band playing some great numbers. God spoke to them, and they just came. And I guess Jonathan Edwards, regardless of whatever his flaws were, was ready to preach to them. And what happened at that time is called the Great Awakening. So Whitefield, from what I can remember, was a Calvinist. Now, he had two friends called John Wesley and Charles Wesley. And they were Arminians. And if you know much about the messy world of theology, you know that Arminians and Calvinists, well, from what I can tell sometimes when I'm listening to them or reading what they said, want to kill each other. Or at least wipe the other out. either by changing their mind or just they wish the other didn't really exactly exist. I mean, I'm not saying they want people dead. Although Calvin, who was a Calvinist, as far as I can tell, was in favor of the drowning of 4,000 Anabaptists who believed in believer baptism, not paedobaptism or infant baptism. And the people at that time felt, well, if they like the water so much, let's just hold them under until they're dead. It just does something to me when I look at the things that have gone on. But my point is this. John and Charles Wesley were Arminians. And John and Charles had some significant differences between the two of them. John thought that basically you had to get saved and then had to perform enough works of righteousness to for it to really be genuine. I don't know, it's a little funny. Did I say John? Yeah. Now, Charles didn't think that. He went to the prisons, to the worst prisoners, the murderers and the ones that they've done horrible, horrible things. And I think they knew they were horrible people. And he preached to them. And a whole bunch of them came to faith. Because he believed that somebody in that condition who was going to be hung not long after could actually be redeemed. And you know what happened when they hung those people? And he was present at the hangings? Those people didn't kick and struggle at the end of the rope. They knew where they were going. You can read about it. And you can decide whether or not you believe it. I believe it. John apparently wouldn't have bothered with those people. John. But Charles did. John also thought that all the ministers had to be highly trained and stuff like that. And Charles was in favor of having itinerants that knew enough to go and tell the gospel to people. John himself ruined Charles' chances at real love by doing something that reminds me an awful lot of what happened in Pride and Prejudice, right? Wrote a letter to the girl he was in love with and explained why she wasn't worthy of a Wesley and that she should just disappear. And they still ministered together after that, though. I don't imagine Charles could have been very happy with his brother. He did get married, and apparently it was pretty miserable. But he served God for the rest of his life. And when he was in his 80s, he was this happy old guy riding around on a pony writing hymns. Though he never saw his own two sons come to faith. Anyway, when they started, Charles, I assume John did the same thing, but he traveled around in England to different towns, different places, and there were prisons, there were jails. All the court dockets were full of cases, and the jails were full of prisoners. You can read about all of this stuff. You can go look it up. A reasonable person should be able to convince themselves that this stuff is true. When they started, that's the way it was that I just described. A few years after, they would come through the same area. There was nobody in the jails, and there were no cases to be tried. Rotten England had been transformed by the truth of the gospel in Yeshua. And John lived long enough to bemoan that the gospel changes things, transforms things. Because of the transformation, it brings prosperity, and apparently because of prosperity, people fall away. Which is probably why in the Torah it says, after you've entered the land and You've got all kinds of grapes and wine and oil, and you're eating and you're happy. Don't start thinking my power and my skill did this and forget about me. But people have a tendency to do that. So anyway, when I read about these people, Whitfield, by the way, from what I can tell of what I can read, seemed to be cut from a little better piece of cloth than the Wesleys. But God took hold of these three guys, and they were all friends, and did incredible things with them because of who God is, not because of who they were. And there are all kinds of other people you can study that did things like, it's just like, wow, you know, you would be amazed. And then you find out about them and you think, wow, God used them? You might even think, I'm not even that bad. Not that you should, but you might. So if you had the power to save people from sin and death, the power in you, I'm not saying it's your power. The scriptures do say we have, if we have come to faith in Yeshua, that he that is in us is greater than he that is in the world. And that the power of the gospel, the power of the resurrection of Yeshua, the power of his blood can come to other people through us. So, have you ever met anybody that was conscious, that was standing on their feet, that was down for the count? I have. Because they don't have to be unconscious and have a rapid heartbeat and weird breathing and look like they're never going to get up. By the way, I found this out from somebody, it makes sense, but I hadn't thought of it. When people see somebody unconscious laying somewhere wearing a suit, they apparently assume it can't be an opiate overdose. I just started laughing when I was told that. It could be anybody, anywhere. And that is the same with the need for redemption. Doesn't matter how much money you're making. Doesn't matter if you have a nice suit and you groom yourself well, or if you smell bad and you're wearing rags, it's all kind of the same. So, moving along here. You don't have to take me completely literally, but I want to say this. Any one of you could be John or Charles Wesley or George Whitfield. Any one of you could be. And it doesn't have to look as big to be just like that. It's, and I believe in God's eyes that the reward for somebody that faithfully does what God gives them to do, even if it doesn't look like he gave that much to them to do, is the same as somebody that did what they were called to do that looks like way more. Because I don't think God really cares about the headlines in the paper or who gets an article printed about them in Charisma magazine. Well, I mean, maybe he cares, but not in the way that I was suggesting. You can figure that one out if you want. Otherwise, just forget it. I don't think it matters whether anybody achieves notoriety or not. I don't think it has anything at all to do with how valuable they are or what they've accomplished. Not really. Yes. Basically in rabbinic Judaism, they say something like, if you have saved one person, you've saved the whole world. Yeah. And there is a true thing contained in that. It's really about perspective, the way you look at things. So, here we have this in Mark chapter 9. There was a boy who was he was afflicted by evil spirits, and he was mute, and they just like tossed him all over the place, and he would foam at the mouth. And I At the moment, I'm not remembering if he's the one that would get thrown into the fire by them. And the disciples of Yeshua came along, and they couldn't cast it out. So Yeshua finally comes along, and they start talking to him. And the father of the young man says to Yeshua, after he tells him, your disciples couldn't cast it out, and he says something like, oh man, how long do I have to put up with these faithless people? Maybe generation. The father says, but if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. And Yeshua says, if you can, all things are possible to him who believes. Immediately the boy's father cried out and said, I do believe, help my unbelief. Apparently you can have both at the same time. Yeshua didn't say, you got some unbelief you're struggling with. Sorry, can't help you. Remember that? When Yeshua saw that a crowd was rapidly gathering, apparently he didn't want the crowd to get so big before he did anything. I guess he wasn't actually looking for personal notoriety. Politicians would wait for as many people to gather as possible, wouldn't they? So, rapidly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, you deaf and mute spirit, I command you, come out of him and do not enter him again. After crying out and throwing him into terrible convulsions, it came out, and the boy became so much like a corpse that most of them said, he is dead. But Yeshua took him by the hand and raised him, and he got up. When he came into the house, his disciples began questioning him privately, why could we not drive it out? And he said to them, this kind cannot come out by anything but prayer. In another gospel, I think it says, but by prayer and fasting. And so just as a note on that subject, have you ever thought about it? Can you pray fast? You can pray fast, can't you? You can't necessarily pray something through the way maybe one might have, or we might say should have, or wish they would have fast, but you can pray fast, right? You can pray on the spot. And sometimes you have no idea what's even coming, and all of a sudden it comes, and you just start praying. Doesn't mean you couldn't have been better prepared, but you can pray fast, and God hears fast, right? But you can't fast, can you? You can't fast quickly. Does anybody call it a fast between bites of a piece of steak? No, you can't fast. There's no way. It's not possible. You can't fast. But you can fast ahead of time for what's coming later. And, you know, I fasted quite a bit when I was younger. I have fast. I still fast, and sometimes I fasted. But I haven't fasted so much for a while, and actually I think that I need to change that. And I'm just going to ask you to consider. I'm not trying to get you to fast. But the Pharisees and the disciples of John did complain about the disciples of Yeshua. They said, hey, you know, we all fast. We fast twice a week, and what's the deal with you? Your disciples aren't fasting. And he said, oh, well, when the bridegroom is with you, you know, you don't fast. But when the bridegroom is taken away, when I'm gone, they'll fast. So, I think between the ascension, at least, and the second coming, there's a place for fasting. And I think what Yeshua was saying is that my disciples will fast during that span of time in which I am not present in this way that I am right now. But right now, they're not going to fast because You know, you don't go to a wedding reception. Can you imagine a wedding reception with all the food and everybody there says, hey, we're not eating anything. They're not even tasting the cake. We're fasting. And the bride and the groom go, wow, this is great. I really feel like they're celebrating with us. Right? No. There's a place for feasting, and there's a place for fasting. And at the wedding reception, and when you're spending time with the groom, isn't a time for fasting. But in between when he leaves and when he comes back, there's a place for fasting. So you can't fast quickly, and you can't fast all of a sudden for what suddenly pops up in front of you. But you can fast beforehand, and you can pray beforehand, even if you don't know what's coming, because beauty of beauty in God's economy, you don't have to know what's coming. And I'm so thankful that usually I don't. I really am. It would have been so much harder in life to know what was coming all the time. People think they want to know. I don't think they really do. I don't. I don't want to know what's coming. I just want to be ready when it comes. There are times when people are given some knowledge about something, but generally speaking, no, we don't know what's around the corner when we're driving. We don't even know if we're going to live past the next corner. We don't know that, and we shouldn't assume it. The scriptures actually tell us not to think that way. So, let's see here. So with respect to this then, I do believe that the disciples of Yeshua had cast out demons before that. This one was a tougher one, apparently. I don't know. How do you decide how tough a demon is? Not really sure. Rodney Howard Brown liked to say at one time that only the demons that couldn't make it in Africa or in America. I think that's kind of funny. I actually think, I don't know if he really meant it, I think the demons that understand people that believe in spiritual forces are in Africa. And I think the ones that understand that in America people worship science and think there are no spiritual forces, I think those are the ones that are here. Because those are the ones that can mess with people that don't believe they exist. But in Africa, generally speaking, over the centuries, people have believed in spiritual forces, have been afraid of them, have hired witch doctors to try to get them on their side, or at least stop them from doing the horrible things that they think they're doing. So they believe in it. So you can mess with them with that belief. But people that worship science and think nothing is spiritual have this confidence that they are safe from spiritual forces because they don't exist. And so those spiritual forces can mess with them, and they don't even know it. Those are the ones that I think are in America. Well, what you believe in your head will affect you. But believing something doesn't exist doesn't cause it not to exist. And believing something does exist doesn't make the thing actually exist. But the stuff in your head can mess with you, just your thoughts. But you and I think, both believe there are actually spiritual forces. So we can settle on that for the moment. So the thing is, we are not the victim of spiritual forces. We have the one who is greater than he that is in the world in us. That is what we have in us. It really doesn't matter. You know, show me a spiritual force that can stand against Yeshua and defeat him. Show me a spiritual force that God can't handle. Any spiritual obstacle simply exists so that God can get glory in the victory. Let's see, the Philistines. The Israelites were invincible as long as they obeyed God. When they didn't obey God, then they weren't invincible. By the way, you can be invincible even if you get killed. Because getting killed doesn't change your destiny. And this space of time that we're here in this present earth in these bodies is so tiny that it amounts to nothing in terms, well, eternity is the end of time. But we think in terms of time. Eternity must be a really long time, even though personally I believe that in eternity, time is no more. The rabbis think of it as the end of time. And also, actually, in Christian theology, I believe the same concept exists. I believe in the end of time. It's a different thing than what we now experience. So, how qualified do you have to be for the power of God to work in you? There's another passage here. The disciple John, at one point, he says to Yeshua, it's in the same chapter of Mark. He says, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him because he was not following us." But Yeshua said, "Do not hinder him, for there's no one who will perform a miracle in my name and be able to soon afterward speak ill of me. For he who is not against us is for us. For whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you are followers of, I don't know what translation this is. My followers, I say to you, he will not lose his reward." So, look, there were people apparently, they were actually casting out demons. It doesn't say they were trying. It says they were. At least that's the way it sounds to me. And they tried to stop them because they weren't following Yeshua. Well, if they were actually doing that in his name without actually following him, then how much more would it be the case that people who know him and are following him would be able to do the same thing? What do you think? It doesn't sound like they had any great qualifications. They weren't even following him. If you can't figure it out, part of what I'm trying to tell you is you are qualified. If you believe in him, you're qualified. If you believe in him, then you have him in you who is greater than he that is in the world. And that means that he that is in the world cannot stand against you because he that is more powerful is in you. It's so complicated. So, you know, we did an outreach at Bard. And by the way, I don't know how many people I've told, but I've told a number of people, Bard students. Sometimes they ask, "Why are you doing this?" Or sometimes they don't ask. But at some point in the conversation, I say, "Well, we're here because we love Bard students." And as far as I can tell, every one of them has truly believed me when I said it. And the thing is, we can go there and we can have like this effect or that effect. But what I want to say, whether it's Bard or somewhere else or just where we go each day, or if you don't go, you can be just as much a part of it as those that do go. When people who really are serving God say that if you're praying for us and if you contribute something to our ministry, and the ones I have the most respect for usually don't beg for it. When they say you are doing the work with us, they mean it, and it's true. It's true. There were people that supported the Apostle Paul. They were part of his ministry. They were part of the effect that he had. They were partners in it. They didn't have to be him or do all the things he did. And so if you pray, and if we all pray more, not because of a legal construct that we put on ourselves that we should pray more, but if the Lord just draws us and we want to see people saved by getting the truth squirted into their nostril when they're about to die, metaphorically speaking, we can be part of it and we can have an effect and we can see fruit regardless of how we have tended to see ourselves. And more, I just really desire that all of us, including me, see ourselves the way God sees us, define ourselves according to what he says about us in his word. Look in the mirror and see a new creation, even though you are struggling with that thing. Even though you see flaws, even though you've been discouraged about them, look in the mirror and see a new creation, because he has redeemed you and caused you to be a new creation, caused you to be the righteousness of God in him. If we reason about it, we can convince ourselves it couldn't be true if we try to use our head. But if we reason and say, well, when God tells me something, he's right. And if he tells me something about me, he's right. And if he's right, I'm going to agree with what he says about me. And you know, if you believe what he says about you, more of what goes along with believing it will happen. It's not that complicated. There might be obstacles, but once again, he that is in you is greater than the obstacles and will bring you through it. So, this is what Paul said about himself. For I am the least of the apostles, and I'm unworthy to be called an apostle, because I persecuted those that were following God. But by the grace of God, I am what I am. And his grace to me was not in vain. No, I worked harder than all of them, yet not I, but the grace of God that was in me, the grace of God that was in him, did the work. That was the power that drove it. That's the engine that drives it, not Paul. Whether then it was I or they, this is what we preach, and this is what you believed. He says, see, even if you heard it from somebody else, it's still the same gospel. Doesn't matter where you heard it from, you believed. It's not about which one you heard it from or who you follow, unless you're talking about Yeshua. See, then it's about who you follow. Those that imitated Paul the right way imitated him as he imitated Messiah and understood that the point was to imitate Messiah, not Paul. And Paul didn't want them to get confused about it. So, you have the power to save somebody's life in you. You have the power of the redemption of God's Messiah in you. It'll do the same thing in spiritual terms that this will do if you've got it and you squirt it up somebody's nose. You didn't invent the gospel. You don't control the gospel. All you have to do is know enough to tell it. You don't have to be a theologian. In fact, I often think it's better not to be. Though theology is something I'm dangerously interested in. And I mean dangerously. It is a dangerous realm to travel around in. You can get so confused and befuddled that you could just lapse into a deep depression and disappear. And I can give you an example of the power of it. I was in Toronto with a good friend of mine the second time I was up there. And I knew he knew a lot about this stuff, and I asked him something about it. And he said, I don't really want to talk about it. And he said, I said, well, it's all right. You know, he says, you'll lose your peace. I said, no, you have understanding that I don't have. I'd like to talk to you about this stuff. So over dinner, we talked about some of it. Next morning at breakfast, I said, I lost my peace. It was nonetheless a valuable lesson. Because you can lose your peace, but your peace can return. But you don't have to have all the answers to all the burning questions. And by the way, I think some of them, God has the answers, but in the truest sense, I do not think we will know them until the end of time has come. Because God, I believe He is sovereign. I can accept that and His place in my life without explaining to you exactly what His nature is in human terms and exactly how it all works. I can get messed up trying to do that. Doctrine matters, but the Scriptures do a pretty good job of defining it. And men that exceed what is written, I think, oftentimes lead people into peril. So, the plain truth of the clearest passages isn't so complex, and the power of the gospel works in you even if you don't have perfect understanding. And if you believe, at the same time that you have something that feels like unbelief and you say, I believe, help me, He'll help you. And if some of you don't realize, sometimes when I show up at an outreach, I'm scared stiff. Sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I'm just fine. I mean, I may not be like in perfect shape, but I'm just fine. Other times it's like, fear! Enough sometimes that it pretty just about cancels me out. I don't have to accept that, but I am just flesh and blood. Sometimes I get whacked. Usually, at least to some significant degree, I just push past it because I know it's not about me. But you don't have to do it perfectly. You don't have to have all the answers. If He is in you, then He is greater. And if He is in you, you can bring Him to someone else. And I will say this too, that, you know, perfect people are the most discouraging people in the world to people that need to be redeemed. They don't have anything to offer. But I will tell you, a lumpy person who has real-life struggles, who has met Yeshua, that tells people the truth, that doesn't act like some sort of perfect specimen and tries to hide all of their warts and lumps, they can encourage people. Because that's easier to believe. If God could save me, well, maybe the person I'm talking to can believe that He can save them too. It's different to meet Yeshua, who is perfect, than to meet a human being who looks like it. It's completely different. And a human being who is hopelessly imperfect can introduce other hopelessly imperfect human beings to the perfect one. And then the light shines on him, which is where it belongs. and redemption comes to the lost. So, you have the Narcan of the Holy Spirit in you. Believe it. Use it. God's going to work. God's going to work. God's going to work. Don't listen to anything else. In Yeshua's name.